From the Denker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm your host, Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we're going to feature a conversation with architectural historian Shandana Yusuf, a professor at the University of Utah who's just published a book about a series of architectural radio programs that ran on the BBC during its early years.
BBC literally started in 1921 as a British broadcasting company, and it had a staff of four people, literally, to begin with. But within 6 years, it had 10,000 people working for it.
That conversation, a surprising revelation about an oil spill on the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, and your top local headlines just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up later on the show, a conversation with an architectural historian about radio programs on architecture that ran on the BBC in its early days. But first up, we have these headlines. Utah Governor Gary Herbert says early negotiations over a Medicaid expansion plan with federal officials are progressing, and he hopes to have a deal by summer. Herbert discussed the negotiations Thursday during his monthly televised news conference on KUED-TV. The governor sent a team to Washington, D.C. last week to propose an alternative plan, using a large chunk of federal money to cover thousands of low-income Utah residents. Herbert, a Republican, says he believes federal officials are open to his plan, which enrolls people in private health care plans instead of the government program. Herbert has not yet outlined the specifics of his proposal, nor how much flexibility he is seeking. An agreement with federal officials will have to be approved by the Utah State Legislature. There is no deadline to approve a plan. Last week, hikers alerted officials to a potential oil spill in the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. After some speculation that it may have been a recent spill, further analysis indicates that it's likely decades old. KCPW's Ryan Cunningham has more.
On Saturday, hikers sent photographs to the Bureau of Land Management and the Salt Lake Tribune that appeared to show damage from an oil spill in the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. Initial analysis leaned towards a recent spill from an oil well owned and maintained by Citation Oil and Gas. But on Thursday, the BLM determined that the spill was actually much older. Here's Megan Crandall, External Affairs Chief for the BLM.
We were able to get a team out there yesterday. We put a team of experts out there. They got their boots on the ground. They hiked the entire wash, took a look at the situation. The consensus is that it's actually a spill that's quite old, 1970-71. So you're looking at something that would have occurred 40-plus years ago.
So how did a spill like this stay hidden for over 40 years? Crandall says it's in a remote area and that its location in an ephemeral wash may have obscured it for years. The spill may have only reappeared recently because of a big storm last fall.
What they think may have happened is that you may recall back in mid-September, we had a period where we had some really heavy storms down in the southern part of the state. And they believe that a couple of those storms pushed the volume of water through that drainage that was significant enough that it actually stirred up some of the material from the old spill and reinvigorated it and kind of spread it down the wash.
Citation then was not responsible for this spill. In fact, Crandall praised the company for being proactive and cooperative throughout the ordeal. KCPW reached out to Citation's home office in Houston, Texas, but was unable to get comment. As for what happens next, Crandall says work has to be done to assess the damage and figure out how to clean things up.
What is the extent? What is the volume? You know, what are we looking at? And until they do that, they really won't be able to determine what that rehabilitation would look like. I can say that it appears that when the spill occurred in 70 or 71, that it was a large spill by our standards today.
Crandall added that the Citation oil well in question produces about 15 to 17 barrels per day, which is less than the same well produced in 1970 or 71, when the spill likely occurred. She also noted that many of the protections in place today to prevent these incidents didn't exist at the time of the spill. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
A South Weber City councilman has been charged in connection with a $200,000 fraud scheme at a Bountiful assisted living facility where he worked as a manager. On Thursday, prosecutors filed felony charges in 2nd District Court against 40-year-old William Michael Poff. Prosecutors allege Poff, from 2008 to 2010, put business funds into his personal bank accounts, paid off credit cards with facility earnings, and used credit cards in the business's name. The Standard Examiner reports he has since been fired. As a city councilman, Poff oversees South Weber Business Development, Eagle Scout and Youth Services projects, and a board tasked with improving the district's sewers. Poff and South Weber Mayor Tamara Long could not immediately be reached by phone. Poff is scheduled to appear in court on April 30th. The State Tourism Office is launching a marketing campaign in western states this week to attract visitors to Utah's five national parks. Utah's Office of Tourism, Film, and Global Branding announced the Mighty Five campaign on Wednesday. It includes online and magazine advertisements, billboards, and television commercials in eight large cities. Vicky Varela, the Tourism Office's managing director, says visitors around the world plan trips to visit Utah's five national parks: Zion, Bryce Canyon, Capitol Reef, Canyonlands, and Arches. The marketing effort also includes a sweepstakes for Denver residents to win a trip to Utah. State officials say tourism is a major driver of Utah's economy. Visitors in 2012 spent $7.7 billion in the state, which generated $960 million in state and local taxes. And that does it for our summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay tuned. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we're speaking with architectural historian Shandana Yusuf, a professor at the University of Utah and the author of a new book from MIT Press that explores how radio broadcasts, starting in the early days of the BBC, used the subject of architecture as a platform for educating and influencing British society. Yusuf's new book is called Broadcasting Buildings: Architecture on the Wireless, 1927 through 1945. It examines how those in power in England hoped to use radio as a means to bring about a more egalitarian society, in contrast to the way that the platform had been used by fascist powers and by consumerist societies. High-minded radio as a mass influencer and cultural education tool. To set the stage, Shandana Yusuf, let's get a brief overview of the early days of BBC, how it was created, its purpose, who made up the staff, and maybe we can talk about what radio at the time was meant to or trying to accomplish.
All right. So BBC literally started in 1921 as a British broadcasting company, not a corporation, which was a commercial enterprise put together by six radio manufacturers to create a market for radio sets. And it had a staff of four people, literally, to begin with. But within 6 years, it had 10,000 people working for it. In 6 years, the managing director of British Broadcasting Company was John Reith, who also became the first director general, and it was him who translated it into a corporation, which is a public-run corporation. And he promoted it as a great opportunity to create democratic discourse within the British nation.
You know, and this is kind of jumping ahead a little bit, but you you contrast that purpose of BBC, what John Reith was trying to accomplish, as being in juxtaposition to what fascist powers were doing with radio, to what kind of high consumerist cultures were doing with radio in other places. Is that correct?
That's correct. BBC, at least John Reith, very consciously, the public radio model, which is and BBC is the first public radio corporation anywhere in the world. And so he opposed it to kind of the American model, which was anybody can set up a radio station, you get a license. So basically, the impulse was either commercial or there wasn't a kind of a larger pedagogic agenda over there. And so that was one model. The other model was how the Russians and the Germans were using it. I mean, we all know that Hitler became Hitler because of his incredible facility with the microphone. And so John Reith considered that propaganda. And so he wanted to open up a space for public radio where you would have kind of a more educational platform. So it is a kind of a patriarchal approach, but it is nevertheless this idea that if we want to have participatory democracy, we have to educate the masses mm-hmm. in certain ideals and certain ideas. And this is a very Victorian liberal ideals. That's why I put BBC within the category of Victorian municipal museums, which were produced or created in the 19th century to bring the working class into the museums. And so there's a whole other kind of a cultural agenda, big cultural agenda that's going on.
And a question that I have about that is whether that Victorian impulse and its extension in this experiment in radio was meant to maintain the class structures that existed in England, in Britain at the time. Or is that...
That has never been consciously the effort of this do-gooder kind of a philosophy. But that is definitely the consequence of it, that you create a kind of a class value system, which is this bourgeois classes and the educated classes value system. For example, if I write this book, I belong very much within the category of the same people that John Reith, in a way, belongs to. I don't think I'm more circumspect than him, but nevertheless, this idea that he brought the most educated, the most idealistic crowd from Oxford and Cambridge to BBC, gave them kind of positions of power, brought some women into the force. People, and the idea was not that they were men or women, but the idea was that they know all the art circles, so he wanted to bring the art circles within it. He wanted to bring the musicians into it, so he wanted to bring a kind of a dialogue between these two. But nevertheless, what it turned out to be was always, which is something that we haven't escaped, that one becomes the teachers of the other group. Mm-hmm. So the other group is then inculcated into the values of kind of this highly elite, which is partially aware of its weaknesses and partially blind to it, which will always be the case.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned the Victorians in England building museums for the masses, and you talk about the BBC being an extension of that impulse. In its early days, your book points out, a lot of the programming had to do with public architecture and home improvement and, you know, debates on buildings even. Why this emphasis on, or why these programs on architecture specifically?
BBC started, was basically, John Reith was really interested in kind of doing political programming. That was his first agenda. He was not so interested in cultural programming at first. But what happened was the Parliament and the newspaper lobbyist, together with the religious segments within the community, they banned BBC from doing any news. Mm. So BBC in the 1924, 25, 26, 27 years, 27, and even afterwards, was not able to do any news broadcasting that was direct because the newspapers argued to the Postmaster General that they're going to use their livelihoods, or they're going to lose their market.
So this was seen as competition to the newspapers?
It was seen as a competition to the newspapers. It was seen as actually being too forceful a player in political controversy, so it would have too much of a pulpit. And it could not talk about commerce at all, global commerce, colonial commerce. It could not talk about any kind of controversial topics, anything that was controversial. So BBC by force had to make room for itself in kind of cultural programming. And when it started doing that, it started doing literature, it started doing teaching languages, it started doing school programs, a lot of stuff. But it realized very quickly two things. It realized that architects were really eager to become a part of this larger political discourse. All right, it's because architecture and as the discipline is also revamping its role in society at this time, and BBC seemed to be a kind of a natural alliance for that. The second thing that happened was that architects were just beginning to talk about town planning. They were talking about working class housing. They were talking about preservation of the countryside. They were talking about modern design. They were talking about industrial production of everything. So when they were talking about these things, BBC very quickly realized that this was the way to go, because it was to talk about politics, because all these things are political issues. Housing is a political issue. Town planning is a political issue. The role of women in a house is a political issue. Outreach into the everyday kind of minute is a public issue. So it was a way of invigorating the market from above and below at the same time. And so they kind of started doing some radio programs, and they didn't understand that this is what it was allowing them to do. But very quickly they realized, and by 1937, 38, by the time the war began in 1939, there was at least one radio program on architecture every day a week, if not two or three programs.
Well, that's remarkable. I'm just going to remind our listeners really quickly that we're speaking with architectural historian Shandana Yusuf, a professor at the University of Utah, who has a new book from MIT Press called Broadcasting Buildings, which looks at architectural programming in the early days of the BBC, among other things. One of the things that you highlight is that architecture is kind of ready-made for a curriculum, for an educational model, because it's ubiquitous. It's in people's daily lives, as the radio itself is quickly becoming ubiquitous at the same time. So maybe we could talk about what that curriculum, or what these programs were, how they were used, how they were implemented. What strategies did they use?
They had three types of, generally to say, they had three types of program. One thing that we need to know is the BBC is the only radio station in Britain, all right? So we do have Radio Luxembourg, we do have the French radio that people have access to, but these are, in a way, illegal in Britain. So the only radio stations, and there's one national program, and then there became kind of proliferation of regional programs. Most of these programs were done through the national program, which was coming out of London, and very quickly they started doing through regional. So the London guys, London architects and critics and all these people started traveling to all these other regions. And so London kind of stayed culturally dominant in this whole project. The kind of programs that they did was basically they had children programs. Then they had adult education programs, which were done for formal or informal listening groups, which were ladies' clubs would gather together in certain people's homes or in a church or somewhere else, in a school in the evenings. There were men's programs that were done in bars. They would be, BBC would provide certain headsets, would provide tables, would provide reading material, and there would be actually BBC-supported staff that was literally at this grassroots level running the conversations that would take place after they heard a program and they read these material. This was literally a wireless classroom. Then there were casual programs, which were part of like a series or would be one-off in the evenings at 7 to 7:20 or 9 to 9:20. So there were all these kind of different programs. They were geared towards housewives. A lot of them, some of them were geared towards the aristocrats who were losing power right now. So they're talking to them about how they could reimagine how they could take on kind of cultural aristocratic role now of cultural aristocracy while they're losing their power over land and all these things.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is the sort of breakup of the country estates in England at the time. How was this funded? It sounds like a massive undertaking when you have these facilitators going out into the country, for example. Let's describe the funding structure of the BBC at the time.
The funding structure worked like this, that every radio set that any legally sanctioned seller would sell, people would pay £1 a year licensing fee that would be collected by the post office. And the post office would keep some of this money and would give the rest to BBC. So even though BBC wanted a much larger chunk of that than they got, it was still a considerable amount of money. So that was the major source of their funding.
And then did these programs have an effect on architects themselves and on architecture at the time?
To talk about kind of a direct effect would be to be technologically determinist, but I can make certain suggestions, which I make in the book. One of the things is that, yes, for example, there is no support in Britain, no appetite in Britain in the 1920s and 30s for any conservation. Historic conservation. It is considered by the New Labour Party that comes up as a kind of welfare for the rich classes which owned these properties, and for the protection of their lands, for the protection of their estates, right? So to reinvent that what was initially kind of private property into kind of national property and allowing people to masses and allowing people who are coming in buses, picnic parties, to have access to private properties, that whole project was partially promoted on radio by architects and by critics and by a lot of people who were pro-conservation, who were the dilettantes of the community at that time. The other thing is, there is no real modern architecture in Britain in the 20s and 30s. But by 1945, modern architecture has totally won a place. But BBC becomes this kind of a preparatory, the radio set becomes this preparatory space for it, because there's all this kind of a disproportional emphasis on modernism and modern style and modern architecture in ways that did not warrant what was going on in the field out there. So you're producing neoclassical buildings, you're producing some arts and crafts stuff, you're producing kind of revivalist styles, a lot of it. But the debates are not about them. The debates are all about kind of modernity, about industrial design, about kind of things, and putting it as kind of that modernism is the way forward, right? For a people, for a country, for a kind of a healthy nation state.
I want to jump back for just a second to the concept, you know, the fact that radio is a relatively new phenomenon. And, you know, you talked about the housewife in her home or someone in the pub or wherever it is that this cultural influencing is happening. And it's happening almost in an effortless way, education through osmosis or something like that. It's,
without resistance.
I'm wondering how big of an influence. Here's what I actually want to get around to, is whether or not radio as an educating force still has that kind of influence.
Can it have that force?
Can it have that force?
I personally think that BBC has never given up on that agenda. BBC is still doing, but BBC is also kind of staying. I mean, this book is very critical of some of the things that BBC did. But in the end, I do kind of think that this is very much my agenda too. That I, for example, teach undergraduates, and I tried to kind of, I used to teach only graduates at one point, but I wanted to do general ed precisely because of the lessons from this book, because I don't want to teach only architects. I also want to teach the future public. I also want to teach the future clients, the future people who would be part of this kind of a public debate on architecture, which is what architects are trying to promote, kind of public interest projects. The School of Architecture, the University of Utah, as well as our planning program, is very much interested in public service work. I work on globalization. I'm very interested in globalization. But the thing is, these things can, radio can still play that role. And I think it is very, very difficult for commercial radio to do that. But you can do that. I mean, you, because you're not beholden to commercial interests. You're not beholden to the same kind of ratings. So through BBC, we have created a room for that kind of debate. And I think that can happen. I mean, preservation is a very touchy subject still in Utah, which is now wanting to kind of reinvent its identity, not as just a Mormon state, but a kind of a multicultural space.
And you've been listening to an interview with Shandana Yusuf, an architectural historian at the University of Utah and the author of a new book from the MIT Press called Broadcasting Buildings, Architecture on the Wireless, 1927 through 1945. This interview went on for quite a while longer. We spoke about a new work that she's engaged in on the 100 most influential buildings in Utah, among a number of other topics. You can find a full version of the conversation as part of this program at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. That's full time for The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, we'll have a conversation about a new report on the cost of housing in Utah with Barbara Stallone from the Utah Housing Coalition. Until then, you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at @KCPWRundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.